Well, thank you very much for inviting me. And I should say at the outset that even though I love Cambridge very much more, my BBC years are something I look back on with enormous pleasure. And I feel very privileged to have been editor of Today, controller of Five Live, head of TV News, director of Sport, and then director of London 2012. And I do think the BBC is an extraordinary and wonderful creation, and I personally owe it a tremendous amount. So what I want to do today is talk about some of those strengths as they're apparent to people within the organisation, along with some of the challenges when you're inside it. But I also want to talk about the issues that the BBC and British audiences face in the coming years, including something about what has been a really very odd start for both sides to the new relationship between a majority Conservative government and the BBC. And I'll touch too on the spending cuts that the BBC has announced today. And I should say that my loyalty to the BBC is qualified in only one respect, and that is that public service media is a greater good than just the BBC, and the two things aren't quite the same. And related to that, we all need to think about society and our democracy. What is the best form of media to foster democratic engagement and plurality in a Britain that's changing rapidly the whole time? It's unthinkable in my view that the BBC shouldn't be the main guarantor of that, but it's also probably a weakness if the BBC is the only repository of true public service. I started working life after my time at, I'm afraid, Oxford, in commercial radio. It was a time when independent local radio, ILR, was by any definition a public service. At Pennine Radio in Bradford, we had a newsroom of up to 10 people. We did an hourly long news programme every night. We had 10 hours of programming a week in Asian languages and a classical music show. There were regular phone-ins featuring local MPs like Dennis Healy and Sir Keith Joseph. He was one of the MPs. He sat in reception with pop music blaring out, reading Proust in French. So I've always had the view that you can both serve a community and run a commercial business. And it's really been a sadness over the years to see that non-BBC radio has become dominated by national conglomerates and by arid musical playlists with much reduced local content. And it has been the BBC that has kept the local flag flying. And my first jobs in the BBC were in local radio, at Radio Lincolnshire and then Radio Northampton. And I saw for myself the virtue of a local news service, of village news, and providing a voice for a county, building a sense of community. One of the things I've mentioned in my book, which just happens to be available afterwards, is that Mrs. Thatcher welcomed the arrival of Radio Lincolnshire in what I think is probably the only example of Mrs. Thatcher welcoming the expansion of the BBC. And she said, "The government attaches very great importance to the expansion of local radio. It can help to strengthen and develop a sense of local community. I'm very pleased there's now to be a BBC local radio station in my home county, and I wish it every success." And I think she was right. And it's worth noting that when we started Radio Lincolnshire in 1980, we had a local newspaper, the Lincolnshire Echo, publishing 6 days a week, three editions a day, plus a strong competing weekly in the Lincoln Chronicle. And now it's just down to the Echo once a week. So there's been a real diminution in local content, even if you allow for local websites. And it's the BBC in local radio and regional television that has kept investment strong. And there's equally no mistaking the decline in ITV's regional commitment over the years. This region, Anglia Television used to be the provider, had a programme called Town and Gown about Cambridge, and it was an autonomous company with a really strong sense of an East Anglian identity. And equally for me, when I was a child, Yorkshire Television, a real inspiration. And all of that has largely gone into a centralised ITV. So if you put that together, the demise of speech-based and locally powerful ILR, the demise of the regional system in ITV, you can see the case for the BBC there as a guarantor against market failure. And over the years, there's been an interesting flip over, really, between the BBC being very top-down and national and ITV being federal into a world when it's the BBC local programmes that are market leaders and the BBC is trying hard to devolve power both to the nations and also to Salford. And it's one of the less appreciated BBC achievements, but having experienced at grassroots what local media means, it's one I've personally been delighted to see. And the question now about the non-BBC media is, can we sustain what's left and even rebuild the commitment to the regions and to localities that used to serve us so very well? I then moved from local radio into network radio, to The Week in Westminster, and then Today and The World at One and PM. And I would guess that this is an audience which knows those programmes rather well, so I've got less need to trumpet those virtues. But I think one of the things you appreciate about Britain is the fact that opinion formers and decision makers are willing to put themselves on the line on those programmes, and there's some vigorous and independent journalism which serves us very well indeed. And looking back, I'm really astonished about the amount of autonomy we had as programme makers to do what we believed was right in journalism. And if you were the output editor, which was a role I first took when I was probably 26 or 27, you really were in charge of the most influential programmes in daily journalism. And there was almost no check or balance. There was no sense of a great management system sitting on top of you. We were very vague about what the senior managers did or who they were, and they never interfered. And we decided what went on air and what didn't. And later in the 1990s, when I became editor of Today, and sometimes had lunch with the newspaper editor, they were used to the ways of Robert Maxwell or Rupert Murdoch, and they would be amazed that the then DG, John Burt, wasn't interfering and giving me guidance about what should be the 8:10 lead. As long as we did a good programme, the BBC supported us. Yet there were a couple of straws in the wind that suggested longer-term problems. The first was the existence of what someone once described cleverly as the mock bureaucracy, a monitoring and metrics outfit which fortunately never really connected with the editorial decisions. And it came in with John Burt and has never really gone away, though the irritation levels and the efficacy can vary. As an example, at one point it became the vogue, for a reason I can't honestly remember, that we should cover more maths, which is pretty difficult on radio. And I was asked as editor of Today to calculate how much more maths were we doing. And when you think about it, it's a ridiculous question. Is it any good? When's it scheduled? Does the audience benefit from it? And if maths have gone up, have chemistry and physics gone down? But we dutifully compared a week in one year with a week in the previous year and came to the conclusion we were doing 17% more maths. And this was a figure that was then proudly included in corporate speeches as evidence of the virtue of the Today programme. And broadcasting is not alone in this, but the hunger for data for bureaucrats has, of course, got worse rather than better. The second worry was the early attempts to create bi-media output, merging the editorial of TV and radio. And that's not a bad idea in principle, especially compared with some of the bad behaviour of the old days when radio would know a strike had been called off and would say that at 1 o'clock, and they wouldn't tell television, who would say the strike was continuing, and that was bad behaviour. But TV and radio are very different media. And a lot of the drive for bi-media was ideological. At one point, I was offered the joint editorship of Breakfast TV and the Today programme, which wouldn't work at all because they're on air at the same time and you can't monitor both. And under bi-media, you'd sometimes struggle to make out a piece of audio on the Today programme and you just knew it was a piece of television soundtrack that had been foisted onto the programme. And meanwhile, all the glamorous TV reporters were sent to the radio salt mines for attachments, where they would sit sulkily at the back of the office. And some radio people, utterly resistant to television, were sent to work on the 9 o'clock news, where they were despised by the programme editors and never allowed on screen. And there are more examples of the risks of greater coordination, to which I shall return. But one of the reasons it didn't quite work is that the newsrooms were not physically together. Television was in TV Centre, radio was at Broadcasting House, the World Service was at Bush House, which made it easier to fight groupthink, or, candidly, to escape the coordinating meetings. And that's something else I'll return to, because I'm inclined to the idea that separate baronies, even if they're competitive, do have some strengths that single empires don't. I then went off from being editor today to become controller of Five Live, which was seen at the time as a bit of a funny move. Why would you want to go from the flagship Today programme, just before the 97 general election, to what was then seen as Radio Bloke? In fact, it was a brilliant idea to run a live news and sports station, and it was part of John Burt's farsightedness, not least because it also targeted a different audience to Radio 4. It was aimed at 25 to 44-year-old men, and it deliberately had a different tone of voice to reflect the need for the licence fee to reflect something for everyone. And it was particularly important at a time when satellite TV was steaming ahead, and there had to be, I think, a free-to-air market, albeit only in radio, for live football commentary. And I do want to say a few words about John Burt, because I believe he was an extraordinarily talented Director General of the BBC in terms of spotting what was going to happen in the future. And as editor of The World at One more than 20 years ago, we started imagining a world in which people might be able to choose their own running orders, courtesy of digital technology. And we were way ahead of our time in foreseeing the disaggregated content that you can now get on your iPad or your smartphone. And as well as Five Live and BBC News 24, John Burt created BBC Online with the first mover advantage on the internet that the BBC still enjoys to this day, and which still irritates the hell out of the newspapers, who were much slower to spot what was happening. And when I went to INSEAD in 1999, going with all the insecurities that public service broadcasters have about the competitive commercial world out there, I found out that I knew more about digital and about e-commerce than almost anybody in the industries who were represented there. And this was therefore, I think, a crucial time in future-proofing the BBC and seeing that news and other genres were moving outside the conventional bulletin's time to becoming something that was ambient, something that's there 24/7 and ultimately on every device that you might have. But my next job was a bit more traditional, and one of the amusements of the BBC is watching the way it perpetually reorganises, putting TV and radio together and then pulling them apart again, slicing by daypart or platform or community of interest, and then re-slicing them to make what they originally had in the first place. So in 1999, television and radio were separated again, and Bimedia died for a time, and I became head of television news, which was, for me, a very good thing, because television then and still remains the dominant medium of the age. And I think it's worth underlining this both and phenomenon. You can't, in my view, not be in digital, yet you also have to remain big in television. And I was amused to see that a book out this summer from Michael Wolfe argues that television is the new television. And it's even, on some measures, resurgent. This may be a slightly surprising statistic to people in this room, but the average amount of television viewing per head was 3.74 hours a day in 2008, and it's now 3.9 hours a day that people in Britain watch television, even though that's slightly off its peak of 4 hours a day in 2010. And around three of those hours are still spent watching live TV, with the rest made up of recordings from your set-top box or video on demand or clips from the internet. So television news when I worked on it 10 or more years ago, and television news now, is still the most important show in town. And around 4 or 5 million people each night watch the 6 o'clock news on TV, and even more watch the BBC's 6:30 regional bulletins. So although terrestrial TV audiences are edging down, they're still very significant, and they're particularly big when you compare them to the rapidly disappearing print market. And it's now not uncommon to find people who think that printed newspapers will be extinct in the foreseeable future, and I don't think anybody would seriously think that about linear television. But after my first introduction to TV, and 5 years on what I like to call the hamster wheel of news, I moved into BBC Sport. And it was here that you see another important facet of television, its ability to bring people together around major events. And even if there are one or two sports phobes here tonight, I can say with utter certainty that only royal events have the capacity that sport has to bring in the most enormous numbers. The figures show that sport is, if anything, becoming even more powerful than the traditional genres like drama and comedy, because they're starting to wane in a more diverse Britain. And if you look at the 2000s, 6 out of the 10 most watched programmes in the 2000s were sport. So I'm not exhibiting the flawed judgment of a football fan here. I'm simply observing that sport is an enormously powerful genre for bringing people together. And what I took from my time in BBC Sport was the absolute conviction that major events must remain free to air and not disappear behind a paywall. If you imagine a World Cup being only on Sky and you had to pay a subscription for it, the numbers would collapse. So two things are required. One, the BBC still needs to spend some of its licence fee on major sport. And two, the regulatory framework should remain that keeps the biggest events free to air, the so-called listed events. And I do therefore think it's regrettable today that BBC Sport appears to be the biggest target of the corporation's new spending cuts. And I'm convinced that you should be able to run a £3.7 billion a year enterprise and have a proper sports strategy. But at the time, more positive thoughts were swimming around in my head about the way televised sport can bring the nation together and the move towards digital. And it was with that in mind that I set out on 2009 on my last big job in the BBC as director of London 2012. And we set ourselves some goals. We had in mind that 1936 and the abdication crisis may not feel like the most logical place to start for Olympic coverage, but it was the year in which radio came of age and people gathered around their radio sets to hear the king abdicate and history be made. And the same happened in 1953 with television, when the coronation was the huge driver for people to go and get their TV sets. And for the first time, TV audiences overtook radio. So we saw 2012, the year of analog switch off, as being the first true experience of digital Britain, the first time that people would get their content in an overwhelmingly digital way on any device of their choosing at the time of their choosing. And you can see simply in the coverage of Olympics that it's developed incredibly rapidly. So in Atlanta in 1996, which is only 20 years ago, there were just two terrestrial channels. By Sydney, the BBC had a website. By Athens, we had the first red button streaming. And for Beijing, we had 6 interactive channels, which sounds a lot, but there are 5,000 hours of Olympics coverage. And even with 6 channels, we could only have 2,500 hours. So someone wrote to me in the first couple of days and said, is there really no long-form fencing that you're showing? And I thought, well, it must be somewhere in those 6 channels. And actually, it wasn't. We didn't have room for the fencing. So for London, we came up with the pledge that we would deliver every single sport from first start of play in the morning right through to the end. So a narrated form on BBC One, but you're able to make your own Olympics from all the content, which we calculated, and it turned out to be true, required 24 channels. So we launched 24 high-definition channels, 24 standard-definition channels, 24 channels streamed online as part of our commitment to bringing every moment to the British audiences. And as a conceptual change, instead of thinking about planning the Olympics for BBC One, we just thought about planning the Olympics content for the whole BBC, and then it landed on the respective channels and digital platforms. And innovation was something that we felt very strongly about. I came to a technology fair in Cambridge a year or two out from the Olympics, and we talked then about our hope that we would have torch cam following the Olympic torch around, which was actually done with 3G technology. We launched Super High Vision, which is about 10 times the quality of high definition. We did coverage in 3D, and we also pioneered all the hardware and the software that delivered those 24 channels. And it worked. The opening ceremony alone was watched by an average of 27 million people, and that compares with a regular top programme like Strictly Come Dancing being seen by about 10 million. And over the 17 days, a total of 91% of the British population, over 50 million people, watched the Olympics, and it was the most watched event since current records began. And it also had a huge satisfaction rate. So 96% said we'd met or exceeded their expectations. And one of our goals, that it would matter as much if you lived in Orkney as in the Scilly Isles, as in Plymouth. It really did feel that people were part of the Olympic experience. And that was a time I felt inordinately proud of the BBC. And I remember one night when I was standing on the roof of the Olympic Broadcast Centre with Mark Bright, the former footballer, and we were just watching the crowds below us in Olympic Park. And he said to me, "I've never felt so proud to be British." And I think anyone who shared that summer would probably feel the same. But also, we felt that it was a broadcasting that brought this alive for the whole of the country and made it something that was a shared national experience. So, summer of 2012, BBC Triumph, and then in the autumn of 2012, the Savile scandal emerged. And if you're in the BBC, you expect highs and lows, but it was a uniquely painful period of going from a great corporate triumph into a disaster in which there were victims of a truly evil man. We had had some previous experience of highs and lows about after the Beijing Olympics, which again the BBC was thought to have done very well, and it was only 8 weeks later that Jonathan Ross and Russell Brand made their appalling broadcast in what became known as the Ross Brand Affair, and audiences rightly censured us for allowing that kind of thing on the BBC's airwaves. And also in my time in senior management, we went through the Hutton inquiry and the competition scandal. And at one point, it did actually feel that the DG's position was in question because of the misnaming of the Blue Peter cat. So there are highs and lows, and sometimes the lows emerge in truly unpredictable forms. In that second half of 2012, I was director of television, which was intended to be an acting role for 6 weeks, and it actually lasted for 9 months, during which time I served four directors general: Mark Thompson, George Entwistle, Tim Davey, who is a Selwyn alumnus, and Tony Hall. And when I say that, you may guess why I started thinking about other roles in the outside world. But I want to talk in a couple of minutes about some of the challenges that were apparent as I left the BBC and how the corporation might be able to cope with them, along with some of the decisions that the government maybe needs to make. As part of that, though, this is about to be Sophie Raworth's big moment. I want to show you an item from the BBC News in 2013. And you'll remember that I said that in my time in television and radio, we and World Service were in separate buildings, the era of Bush House, Television Centre and Broadcasting House. And then a couple of years ago, that all changed.
We're making a little bit of television history today with the first BBC One News Bulletin to be broadcast from what's now the biggest and most high-tech newsroom in Europe. Nick Higham reports on how the technology of television news has changed.
In the Commons, Mr. MacLeod has said that the London busman's pay claim...
BBC News 1950s style. No auto cue, hand-drawn maps and graphics, a black-and-white business that relied on laboriously processed news film. Then, around 1980, the switch from film to video, a revolution.
And the fighting after it was, if anything, fiercer than it was before.
Everything changed in the early 80s with the arrival of the handheld electronic camera. And the marvellous thing about that was, you didn't know how to process it, you could edit it in the field. So people like myself, we had this wonderful sense of freedom. We could be thousands of miles from this sort of editorial hub that you see here, and we had to be trusted.
There was a second revolution too. Originally, news films shot abroad had to be packed up and sent unprocessed by plane, arriving a day or more late. Satellites changed all that. But today, even satellite trucks like this could be replaced by the internet, broadband, and smartphones.
We've got sandbags against the doors.
This live interview last year was broadcast using just an iPhone. Now the studios too are at the cutting edge, largely automated and computer driven.
For the first time, we are broadcasting in true high definition, and we've got shiny new studios that are bright, they are airy. For the first time in a long time, we've gone back to having a real newsroom backdrop.
That newsroom is Europe's largest. Impressive, certainly.
It reminds me of a sort of battery hen factory with electronic add-ons, but I'm sure it's going to produce some wonderful news. What matters is the people, really, but not the machinery.
Well, here to explain a little bit more about those changes and our new state-of-the-art newsroom is Nick Hyam, right behind me there.
Yes, indeed. Here it is. It's absolutely enormous, and it's the base for 2,500 journalists. It brings together the BBC's television news, radio news, online news, and for the first time, BBC World Service and 29 language services as well. And at its heart, this news desk, home news that side, foreign news that side, and fanned out around it, desks at which are working producers and editors are working at all of the various different bits of output. So you've got television news bulletins there, got BBC World Service there, BBC News Channel over there, the online news desk over there, and it's part of a £1 billion project, 6,000 staff working here in a new headquarters for the BBC alongside its iconic 1930s headquarters, got all the latest technology as you'd expect, and some old technology too. Some of us still read old-fashioned newspapers. They tidied that table up, I notice. Journalists, of course, very messy people. And at the back of the room, the galleries, as they're called by the BBC, the studio control rooms. This is the control room for studio E. Barry, the director, outputting this very programme, and this studio and gallery will be home in the future to the news channel and to all the bulletins on BBC One. Sophie.
Nick, thank you very much.
So, there you have, in many ways, a great success story. A lovely new building, an integrated newsroom, and wonderful technology. A senior colleague of mine used to joke, perhaps unwisely, it's amazing what you get for £1 billion. The reason for doing it, though, was to unlock significant cost savings by bringing those newsrooms together, sharing facilities and working more efficiently. And this has been done. But it does, in my view, have an editorial price, which is a risk of greater homogeneity. As opposed to a programme in Broadcasting House deciding to cover one story and another in Television Centre opting for another, and at times of the day, even the 6 o'clock and 10 o'clock news going their different ways, now it can't happen because they have the same editor. And in one sense, it's internal business and it makes sense financially because you make fewer deployments but more effective ones. You pump out material from your outside broadcast for TV and radio and online. But actually, it means for viewers there is a risk of more of the same. And the worry here is that the BBC is almost too successful in a news market for its own good. ITN isn't the force it was. The BBC News Channel overtook Sky News some years ago. And it now seems that BBC News has around 70% of the television news market. It has at least 70%, and I suspect more, of the radio news market. And then you have the BBC's manifest strengths online with all that first mover advantage. And therefore the problem might be when you marry the increasing central control and potential homogeneity with the market dominance. And that's not to say that the overall director of BBC News isn't a very good chap, because he is. But you can see that if the BBC decides it's Artificial Intelligence Week on the BBC, as it did earlier this autumn, and all the outlets then follow suit, that you have both a great impact for Artificial Intelligence Week, but B, the opportunity cost of having chosen to make it Artificial Intelligence Week and not one of the million other things it could have been. And I think with that homogeneity comes the risk, however inadvertent, of bias. And the BBC itself now says that 10 years ago, it didn't cover enough the arguments against immigration or in favour of withdrawing from the EU. And there are, most likely now, similar omissions. And they're not just ones on the right. The BBC Trust itself, a couple of years back, gave an example of two views that are seldom heard on the BBC. One of them, Britain was a better place to live when the trade unions were stronger and more able to represent the interests of working people. Another one, electricity, gas and water are essential services which should be compulsory taken back into government ownership. So views outside the mainstream on both left and right risk not being heard. And I would admit that in my day, the BBC was slow on the rise of UKIP. And I think this year, on the other end of the political spectrum, it was slow on the rise of Jeremy Corbyn. And I don't think it particularly understands Jeremy Corbyn as a leader from the left any more than it understood Ian Duncan Smith as a leader from the right. And that may be, in both cases, a correct political judgment, but it's one that dominates the daily reporting precisely because the BBC dominates the daily reporting. And then, as well as news doing well, BBC Radio and television are doing pretty well too. So BBC Radio has a 52% market share, compared with 44% for commercial radio. In television, BBC One is way ahead now, streets ahead of ITV, and ITV floundering in many genres, including entertainment and comedy. But the BBC is powering ahead with everything from Strictly Come Dancing to Dr. Foster. And the intriguing thing about that is it really wasn't expected. And the 2010 licence fee settlement seemed at the time to be remarkably tough, not just a five-year freeze, but also having to bear the costs of S4C in Wales, some hypothecation for local television, and at a very significant cost, funding World Service from within the domestic licence fee. And that led many of us at the time to think it was going to be a really serious competitive struggle. And I don't in any way underestimate the pain of the efficiencies that have been made and the difficulties that's caused for many of my former colleagues. But you can see this is a somewhat double-edged position to put in front of the government as the charter renewal process begins and a new licence fee settlement is imminent. The BBC went into that negotiation with a big lead over commercial radio, a massively better performance than ITV, 70% of the TV news market, 70% of the radio news market, iPlayer, wonderful online proposition. And you can see there is a bit of a challenge for how you convincingly argue in an age of austerity that you need more money. And that, I'm pretty sure, is why the government thought it was relatively low risk for them to dump onto the BBC the costs of the television licences for over 75s, which looks in fact like an enormous blow to the organisation with a price tag of up to £750 million a year. And here you have this funny summer for the BBC. And I think it's pretty clear that George Osborne always wanted to offload pensioners' licence fees from the welfare budget and onto the BBC. He tried in 2010 and was stopped by the Lib Dems, and he succeeded now. Now, the reason it may not be quite as bad for the BBC as it first looks is they hope that some pensioners will continue to pay the licence fee voluntarily. And in an absolute emergency, it's the BBC who own the criteria for the qualifying for those licences, and they can even abolish concessionary licence fees. So the BBC has that emergency button if it gets very tough, which may be why the BBC accepted the deal with apparent equanimity. But then it became, in my view, somewhat overwrought about the government's green paper on the future of the BBC, which actually asked some perfectly sensible questions. But the BBC went into, it's possibly slightly less appealing, existential crisis mode, too much positioning, in my view, about it being whether the BBC survives at all, as opposed to a rational debate about the kind of shape that it should have. And I think here there is a bit of a flaw in the BBC in that it tends to have an expansionist view of its role in a digital age, and it finds it difficult to contemplate the status quo. And they've probably struggled, I think, to get the language right in a world of public sector restraint and government austerity. But if the BBC didn't get everything right, and no organisation does, the new Secretary of State, John Whittingdale, behaved very oddly too. And in his public interventions, he managed to get a hair running about whether the BBC should be making Strictly Come Dancing, which he may have intended to be about its scheduling, but it allowed the BBC quite rightly to assert its absolute right to make very good popular entertainment programmes, Strictly is a BBC triumph. And what Whittingdale and the BBC should probably have locked horns about was the raft of rather less good entertainment programmes that also emerged from the licence fee. You may or may not remember That Muppet Game Show, prized apart, In It to Win It, and quite a lot of others. But then, even more weirdly, Whittingdale challenged the BBC scheduling of the 10 o'clock news and said it should perhaps allow ITV to have that slot as a clear run. And anyone who knows the history of it, and it's in the book, knows that the BBC only moved to 10 o'clock because ITV moved out. And even today, ITV shifts its news whenever there's a football match or something really vital like I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. So once again, the BBC was perfectly justified in telling the Secretary of State to take a running jump. And what I sense from the BBC now is it sees its future funding deal as being one that's underwritten by the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, who don't probably want a further fight with the BBC or a significant diminution. And the DCMS seems to be rather more marginal to the discussions. And meanwhile, it's left to others to make some of the more pertinent criticisms. Even though my heart beats with loyalty for the BBC, I did secretly quite like the ITV quote, when ITV said, "It's hard to see the case to spend the licence fee on a 42nd series of Bargain Hunt, the 19th series of Homes Under the Hammer, the 16th series of Escape to the Country, or the 11th series of Antiques Road Trip." But the bigger long-term worry for the BBC is about the whole concept of the television licence fee. And it really was simple in the days when there was one television set in the house and you paid your licence fee for it. But now there's been the astonishing rise of the tablet and smartphone. So what we hoped people would do in the Olympics, watch it whenever, wherever they wanted it, is now really happening. And you can see the effect on the number of conventional TV sets. And what we saw last year, for the first time in British history, was a decline in the number of television sets. I don't know how they quite know this, but it went down from 26.33 million to 26.02 million, so a drop of about 300,000 sets. And as a sign of what's happening, there are now getting on for 1 million homes with a broadband connection but no television. And they are probably not paying a licence fee, but they are almost certainly watching some programmes from the BBC via the iPlayer. And if they only watch recorded programmes, then at the moment they don't have to pay a licence fee. And I mentioned at the start that the BBC made some cuts announcements today, and they actually blamed that for the cuts. They said the shortfall of £150 million has arisen because as more people use BBC iPlayer, mobiles and other online catch-up, the proportion of households owning a TV is falling, while a loophole allows viewers to watch catch-up TV without a licence. And with the BBC's urging, the government has now said it will bring forward legislation to allow the BBC to charge for online catch-up viewing. But a BBC executive came to dinner at Selwyn a while ago, and as we looked out at the students in Hall, I asked him whether they would be expected to pay the licence fee for iPlayer if they want to watch it for catch-up. And he said he supposed they probably would. And you can see that that generates a huge set of practical problems. First of all, how do you technically arrange it so that you show you have a licence fee before you can access the iPlayer? How do you police smartphones and tablets? And there's a really simple point. If Hannah and Josh, when they come to Selwyn, can they still use their parents' login from home? With my BT Sports subscription, I'm allowed to use three mobile devices to access live content, but how many devices could you access with a license fee or the permit to get into the iPlayer based on a household that could be one person or eight? And there are further complications in that the government's proposal is that you would need a license fee to access any public service on-demand content, thus covering ITV and Channel 4. And they, in response, have said they don't want to be within that zone. They get no licence fee money, so why should viewers be forced to pay to access ITV Player or Channel 4 online? And as Channel 4 said last month, and I quote, "We believe that the current proposals are poorly targeted they place an additional burden on commercial PSBs who receive no benefit from a license fee. It would place commercial PSBs at a direct disadvantage to rival commercial video on demand services by requiring them to limit access to non-license fee paying households. So you would be left with an anomaly in which you wouldn't need a license fee for Netflix or Amazon, but the second you start trying to stream Homeland from Channel 4, you would need to pay the BBC a license fee. So you can see the problem there. It also, I think, puts the BBC into a different market. And I've talked about this with students, and they generally, I think I should say, are not enthusiastic about the idea of paying £145.50 for the iPlayer, not least because Netflix is around about £6 or £7 a month, or even free if you open a particular bank account. So it would be around about half the price of the BBC licence fee. And what they see you getting there is lots of box sets and movies, whereas some of the more jaundiced ones think the BBC is all about unwanted stuff like Last Tango in Halifax and millions of editions of Escape to the Country. So in a straight runoff for students between Netflix and iPlayer, Netflix, they say, is cheaper and better, and they don't want to pay a BBC licence fee if they can possibly help it. Now, it's unclear whether one of the other ideas being considered, replacing a licence fee with a household tax, that's a system where every household pays for public broadcasting, irrespective of whether it even has a TV. It's not clear whether that would apply to students, but they're certainly on the licence fee database. Now, there are possibly some opportunities for the BBC in this new environment. And one of them is based on the ability to deliver paid content through mechanisms like the iPlayer. And it's not the opponent's plan, it's close to what the BBC has just launched in the past couple of weeks. And the idea is that you'd have free access to recent programmes for 30 days after transmission, but from 31 days onwards, you might pay £2.99 to access a programme through what's called the BBC Store. And I looked at it last night, the current series River is on offer there at the moment for £9.99. And you could also use it to download and own a programme at any time. And it is a response, really, to the collapse of the DVD market, and in many ways is a very, very good idea. But you can see some challenges too. It doesn't entirely make sense why something's free on day 29 and you pay for it on day 31. There's a sense too that you end up paying for something again that you've already paid for through the license fee. And you could say that with DVDs, but at least you feel you've got something more physical. And the next question is, if you pay, and the going rate I saw last night, it's £1.89 per episode for Wolf Hall, why would you not also be able to buy access to a BBC channel or some other kind of premium service? And the BBC is currently opposed to this, but it actually may be one of the solutions to its longer-term funding. Perhaps if you've got a core curriculum, BBC One, BBC Two, the radio channels, from a licence fee, but you paid a bit more to get BBC Four or live streaming of the proms. So to take the proms as an example, you'd get the current volume of proms on television, but if you wanted to watch every single one to have a digital season ticket, you might pay a little bit more. And I sense that many people in the BBC think this is potentially a good idea. But of course, once you accept the idea of subscription for one thing, what happens if the politicians force you into subscription for everything, thus destroying the basis of a free-to-air, accessible BBC? So as I draw my thoughts together, and I'm going to be interested in your questions in a few moments, I just want to come back to where I started by saying I have a loyalty to the BBC, but also an even greater commitment to public service media. And if I have a criticism of the BBC, it is that it tends to want to cover every possible angle when there are alternative means of delivery. So if you take the shortfall in local news content, the answer to the loss of the Lincolnshire Chronicle or the Lincolnshire Echo is not necessarily to have even more BBC in Lincolnshire. And there, as in Cambridge, the answer might be to look at more support for community radio, supporting journalism on local websites, investing in journalism and sharing of material which might be outside the BBC's branding and its editorial guidelines. And the key thing here is range and diversity of voice. just as in the national sphere, I think it was really a shame that Channel 4 never managed to launch Channel 4 Radio, there should be competition for BBC services. They might take a different angle, bring on new talent, bring on the innovation, which isn't always possible in newsrooms like the one we saw. And you have to look too in television news to see whether there might ever be a need for public support for ITN or for Channel 4 News or for other high content public service material. The essential thing is to stop all the media being the same and to encourage difference and diversity, to foster boldness and risk-taking. And before anyone says this is top-slicing of the kind the BBC doesn't like, the BBC is already top-sliced. S4C is the best example of that, and its support for local television. The question is, can it be more effective? And sometimes, when you watch swathes of daytime television, you do believe there might be some better investments the BBC could make. So, let me conclude and say where we are with the BBC. The new government has bashed the BBC and has not treated it well, but the BBC remains a big beast. My sense is there's little appetite to take it on further, and David Cameron is generally a rather pro-BBC Prime Minister. At the moment, the licence fee is the least worst option, but a household tax is on the agenda, and the BBC faces a real challenge in how it guarantees long-term funding. For the BBC itself, as I say, subscription is lurking there as a partial option, and I think it's a red herring to say it's impossible, but it does give you a potential dagger at the heart of the BBC if it's misused by politicians. I do, though. I'm allowed at Selwyn to take part in supervisions a couple of times a year, and one of the ones I'm allowed to do is about the history of the BBC, which is part of History 1B. And the thing that gives me confidence in the BBC, and which I believe will be true through these storms as well, is that when you look at the BBC going back nearly 100 years, it's had squalls and rows and funding challenges and Annan inquiries and Pilkington inquiries, all the rest of it, and it still tends to come out in pretty much the same shape and pretty robust and still loved by the British people. And I believe it will this time. But I hope in doing so, it can be a little bit more porous, a little bit less rigid, and it can partner more, enable more, because that way the BBC can truly be at the centre of public service media and something that Britain can remain deeply proud of. Thank you very much.